You're listening to Live from Lord North Street, a podcast from the Institute of Economic Affairs. Today we're joined by Dan Hannan, MEP for South East England, President of the Institute for Free Trade, and a leading voice in the Vote Leave campaign, interviewed by the IEA's chief economist, Julian Jessop. With European and British negotiators seemingly at loggerheads, Dan gives his view on what's actually going on behind closed doors. Dan and Julian also discuss how much, if anything, should be paid in a Brexit bill, what the transitional arrangements should look like, and the potential benefits of trading unilaterally. If you like what you hear, be sure to check out more of our podcasts on iTunes.
So Dan, thank you for talking with us. What's your assessment of how the Brexit negotiations are going so far?
A lot better than you would think from the headlines. This is partly a structural problem. You know, I was in newspapers for 12 years before I went into the European Parliament, and I don't remember any editor, I worked under eight different ones, ever coming in and saying, write about how things are getting a little bit better. You know, it's the job of a reporter to find the obstacles, not to find the opportunities. But if you look at the formal stated positions of the two sides, you see a lot more proximity than is being suggested. You know, they agree that they want trade. They agree that they want security cooperation, defence cooperation, intelligence cooperation. They agree that they don't want a hard border in Ireland. They agree on guaranteeing the rights of those of their nationals who have already settled in each other's jurisdictions. So if you focus on what they've had to really think about, what they've had to write down as their formal positions, rather than the off-the-record stuff that journalists tend to overvalue, I think you'll find that there is a sort of 85% overlap. And I would have thought, of course, there's always a chance of things spiralling hopelessly out of control because of some disastrous misreading of each other. But the chances are still that both sides will pursue their own self-interest, and that logically means a mutually advantageous deal.
We have to admit, though, it looks unlikely that a comprehensive free trade deal will be done in time for March 2019. So both Labour and the government are coming up with various transitional proposals to tide us over until a full trade agreement can be done. What do you make of the transitional arrangements?
Well, I've always thought that there would need to be some kind of bridging arrangement. I think it is possible to agree a comprehensive post-EU relationship within the timescale. I think it is not possible to agree and implement it. There are an awful lot of technical things that you need to do. I mean, of course, this was the argument, funnily enough, for Vote Leave throughout the campaign, that the EU had taken over so many aspects of our domestic life and had become so sort of enmeshed in things that are not obviously cross-border in their nature. It was never really just going to be possible to say all of this finishes at midnight on the 31st or whatever. So I think there will need to be some transitional agreement. And the way I look at it is this. The day after Brexit is going to look very like the day before. That's the day that a divergence can begin. That's the day that we can begin to reorient, to follow a different trajectory, one that leads away from an overregulated and slightly sclerotic European market and towards the more opulent markets further overseas.
So that seems consistent with the idea that the day after Brexit, we're still a member of something very similar to the single market, still a member of something very similar to the current customs union. Might there not be some people disappointed if nothing fundamental appears to have changed the day after Brexit has taken place?
One of those things in the debate is people talk about the single market and customs union as though it were a single entity. And of course, as you know, Julian, they are two very, very different things. The single market is not a single entity. It is an accumulation of lots of different rights and obligations, some of which we find onerous and will want to get rid of, some of which we should be prepared to keep transitionally, some of which we should want to keep in the long term, because they're good in themselves. Mm-hmm. So, for example, I would argue that the real basis of the single market is the rule that says that you may not discriminate against the goods or products of another member on grounds of nationality. Now, I'm not aware of anyone in the Vote Leave side who is against doing that. Plainly, a law that benefits consumers and boosts the economy of all participating countries. So it may very well be that, you know, Swiss style, we choose to maintain quite a lot of the practical arrangements through domestic legislation and through bilateral treaties. You can do that outside the ECJ just by doing it as a friendly country. The customs union is something different. To stay in the customs union would be to say that the EU would control all of our trade policies, and all of our trade deals without our having any say over what those trade deals should be. Now, that is such an absurd position. You should only have to state it for people to see what's wrong with it. And indeed, it's telling that nobody, even in the EEA countries, wants to join the customs union. You don't find any campaign in Norway or Liechtenstein for people to join the customs union. It just seems bizarre to them that they'd want to give up their trade deals with China and Japan and so on. So I'm afraid I'm left with the impression that a few Remainers, you know, who'd never really heard of the customs union 2 years ago, are now just snatching at anything as a sort of totemic thing that they want to win on. But I come back to the basic point. It will be a gradual transition. It will be a process, not an event. And for the simplest of all reasons, we've spent 44 years more adopting every one of these wretched regulations. All of them are going to be in place on the day that we leave. So that's the day that we can stop applying the new ones and gradually start unspooling some of the old ones. But I think the exemption from the new stuff is going to be the more significant. You'll know as an economist that even when regulations are deeply unpopular, once they've been complied with, the companies that have assimilated the compliance costs become much more relaxed. In fact, not just relaxed, become quite insistent on keeping them because they don't want the next guy to have a free ride and be able to undercut them. You know, we've seen this happen with, plucking an example more or less at random, the Alternative Investment Fund Managers Directive of the European Union. You could not find a single supporter of that in the UK at the time. Labour, Conservative, no one in the industry. Now that they've all done it, it's not a priority for them to undo it. And indeed, many of them have now invested in it, and there's this, you know, what Milton Friedman calls the tyranny of the status quo. So I think that the real benefit will be a gradual and cumulative one. As the EU goes down the road towards deeper regulation, financial transaction tax and so on, Britain will be able to stand aside.
So what steps should the government be starting to take from March 2019 when it has the additional freedom to negotiate its own free trade deals, to deregulate the economy and so on? What do you think its priorities should be?
The priority must be the trade deals. The EU and therefore the UK has no trade deal with the world's largest economy, the United States, nor with its second largest economy, China. Nor even actually with Japan, although they've penciled in the outline of what it might look like. But, you know, contrary to the headlines, there is no such trade deal, and it may well not exist by the time we leave. Nor with the really fast-growing economies. You know, there's no trade deal with India, there's no trade deal with Mercosur, nor are there trade deals with some of our closest friends and allies, such as Australia and New Zealand. So that has to be the priority. Beyond that, I think that our priorities are really domestic. Here's a hard thing that should be said and that neither side wanted to admit during the campaign. 90% of the prosperity of the UK will be determined by domestic decisions, unrelated to what deal we get from the EU. If we have lower, flatter, simpler taxes, if we have light but effective regulation, if we become a place that people want to invest, we will prosper. And if we don't, we won't. And whatever deal we get with the EU is only really tangentially going to impact on those things. It's up to us. And in a way, this was the whole point of Brexit. It takes responsibility back.
Well, staying with the theme then of embracing free trade, acting, if you like, as a global champion, what do you make of the argument that we should adopt unilateral free trade? In other words, we shouldn't wait for other countries to lower their trade barriers with us. We should just go ahead and reap the benefits of lowering the barriers that we currently have with the rest of the world straight away.
Well, everybody agrees that the optimal scenario is where it's reciprocal. You know, in a world where there are no government barriers at all, where goods and services can flow freely, everyone accepts that that is the sort of platonic ideal that everyone gets wealthier. The question then becomes, does Britain try and use its negotiating strength as a big G7 country to push the world towards that, which to some extent would cost us because it would mean that we would be slower to embrace free trade ourselves because we were making it dependent on the decisions of others? Or do we say that our first obligation is to our own population and that we want to have the cheapest possible goods here because that means that you free up more time to invent and sell and make other things and you prosper? By the way, this was the secret of what raised us above the run of nations in the first place. I mean, Britain's golden age in the Victorian era had no particular cause except that we didn't have tariffs. It was that simple, the same formula that's worked for Singapore, for Hong Kong, for New Zealand now. I think in reality, the best we can expect in practical terms is some combination of the two. I think that when it comes to tariffs, we should unilaterally remove them. You know, as the New Zealanders kept on saying, tariffs are rocks in your own harbour. when they were negotiating in the WTO. Tariffs are placing rocks in your own harbour. The country imposing the tariff always suffers the most. It may incidentally damage an exporter, but unless it is the United States and the exporter is Haiti or some little tiny place, the damage is always disproportionately to the protected economy. When it comes to mutual recognition and standards, then I think there needs to be much more of a deliberative and reciprocal process. So I think realistically, we're going to have a bit of each.
Well, turning back to our relationship with the rest of the European Union, as you know, Labour has essentially proposed that we remain a member of the single market and the customs union for a transitional period of uncertain length. What benefits do you see from that, or perhaps more importantly, what risks?
I mean, there is no benefit. If you break it down, I've had this conversation with a number of Labour MPs, you know, in green rooms of studios where they say we have to stay in the... And when I say to them, why do you want to stay in the customs union, they have no answer. And it's perfectly clear what's going on. They're looking for any issue on which they can, as they see it, defeat the government and hasten another election. And this is nothing to do with any kind of cost-benefit analysis. To repeat, it is absolutely crazy to contract out all of your trade policy to Brussels and then have no say over how they exercise it. So the only way in which that policy makes sense is as a holding arrangement that is designed to allow us to come back in again. In other words, it's a way of overturning the referendum result without being open about what it is you're planning to do. And I just think that underestimates people's intelligence. I think the electorate sees pretty clearly what's going on.
Well, is there a risk, though, that Brexit doesn't happen at all, either that it gets formally stopped, or we end up with a situation which essentially replicates the economics of the current relationship, where we remain in the single market, remain in the customs union? So, to use the dreaded phrase, Brexit doesn't mean Brexit.
Well, I think the first of those things is vanishingly unlikely. If you just think of what would need to happen to overturn Brexit, you would need to have an early dissolution. You'd need to get around the two-thirds of MPs who'd need to vote for an early dissolution. You'd then need to win an election on an anti-Brexit platform. Now, at the last election, as we know, the anti-Brexit parties got 85% of the vote, and all of the pro-Brexit parties, the Lib Dems, the SNP, Plaid, and so on, all lost ground. You'd then need to hold another referendum. You'd need to get the legislation through to hold a second referendum in defiance of what a lot of MPs had promised. And you'd then need to win that second referendum, and you'd then need to persuade the other 27 to reverse their previous stance. And you'd have to do all of this before March 2019. I think when you set that out, you realise that stopping it is just not realistic. And what all these commentators are missing is that Article 50 begins a legal process now, which has a momentum of its own, and the clock is running. In terms of, though, how much of the existing dispensation might we carry over, either temporarily or in the long run, here I think we just need to make a decision as a nation. How valuable to us is the EU, which is our single biggest trading partner, if you treat it as a single entity? How long is it going to be that way? Do we prioritise, let's say, shadowing or mimicking EU standards the way that the Swiss do, for example? I mean, an awful lot of Swiss domestic standards, for reasons of economy of scale, it suits them to have the same standards as those of their neighbours. They conduct a lot more trade with the EU than we do in proportionate terms. Or do we want to be much more kind of Singaporean and radical and, do we want to be slashing regulations and becoming the growth hub of this part of the world? I think realistically, we will move from the first of those to the second over time. And it will be a quite natural process as the EU ceases to be such a big part of our trade. I mean, when people say the EU is 45% of our trade, I mean, that's begging the question. It was nothing like that when we joined. It is that because of the tariff policies that we're now in, and those tariff policies will cease when we leave. And there will then be, I think, a natural hastening of what's already happening, which is an increase of our non-EU trade and a decrease of our EU trade. And as that happens, our standards and our regulations will follow. But remember, standards and regulations become obsolete on their own without needing to be scrapped. I mean, this is the incredibly good news, it seems to me, if you're a free marketeer, right? Who cares these days what the standards are on steamboats or on dial telephones, right? Technology moves much faster than government regulation. So when we're out of the mechanism for the automatic adoption of EU standards, that in itself will have a cumulative and over time really very significant impact on the profile of our economy.
Well, moving on to two final and perhaps politically most controversial issues. The second will be the Brexit bill, but the first is migration. Obviously, one of the arguments for leaving the European Union was to have greater control of the flow of people and workers between the UK and the rest of Europe. What policies would you advocate that the government should undertake when it has those freedoms? To what extent should it exercise control or leave things as they are?
Well, I all the way through the campaign, and indeed long before it, said that we should have free movement of labour, and that the right to take up a job or indeed an offer to study in another country is a good thing. For some reason, Remainers get very angry when I say this and think that I've sort of backtracked or something. This is something I've said all along. The problem really, in terms of the EU, began with Maastricht. You see, we'd always had free movement of labour. We'd always had a right to take up a job in another member country since 1972, and nobody had bothered really about it. What happened was that Maastricht introduced a new factor, which is citizenship of the European Union. And once you become a citizen of the European Union, you get a number of justiciable rights, including residence and voting and social security claims, and indeed things like, you know, equivalent university tuition subsidies and this kind of thing. Often, by the way, rights which are invented or at least expanded by the European Commission and Court of Justice way beyond anything that the member states thought they'd agreed to. Now, outside the European Union, plainly, we will cease to be citizens of the EU and those automatic justiciable rights will lapse. But I am quite in favour of, through bilateral legislation and treaties, having the continued right to take up a job offer in another country, or indeed to come and study. I mean, this is a huge export owner for us. And the interesting thing is that the opinion polls broadly support me. People say that they want skilled labour in big numbers. I mean, you know, 70-80% of British people say they want qualified EU nationals to come here to take up work. Almost, you know, the figures on wanting overseas students is even higher, and with good reason. You know, it's not just that they bring an awful lot of money in, it's the soft power. You know, half the world is now run by people who have fond undergraduate memories of Britain. It's a great asset for us. So I don't think the Brexit vote, except in the minds of some very angry Remainers, was ever about stopping that. And it surely ought to be possible to find a system where we can change our welfare rules, we can change the rules on subsidy, we can start charging people to come to university again, but where the basic right to come and take up a job remains. And I would, by the way, like to extend that right, not just to the 27 allies we have in the EU, but to many of our friends in the Commonwealth as well.
And the other potential sticking point politically is the so-called Brexit bill, the divorce bill, or the financial settlement, whatever you like to call it. In the last few weeks, we've had suggestions that the government might actually be willing to pay as much as £50 billion as a final payment to the European Union, perhaps in return for some sort of transitional arrangement lasting several years. What do you think of that in particular?
Well,
I've got no
problem at all with paying in exchange for receiving something. I mean, I'm guessing people listening to an IEA broadcast will get that concept without any difficulty. There's nothing wrong, as Christian Niemitz of the Institute likes to say, there's nothing wrong with cherry picking as long as you pay for the cherries, right? It's a basic freedom. So let's break down the money that we're talking about. We're talking about three different categories of cash. The first and the smallest of them is what Britain is legally obliged to pay under any normal end of a treaty organisation. So, you know, the pensions of British Eurocrats and this kind of stuff. Okay, fine. We're not the kind of country that walks away from its debts. That's uncontroversial, and it's a relatively small amount. Secondly, there is paying for any EU programmes that you wish to remain part of and that the others wish you to remain part of. So there are lots of EU schemes which are open to non-members. The main educational exchange programme, Erasmus, that runs from Norway to Turkey. You know, if we stay in that, and there seems to be, I mean, frankly, it's not something I'm terribly interested in either way, but plainly there is demand in this country and in Europe for us to stay in it. Okay, of course we'd pay our share of the bills. I mean, no one would argue with that. The scientific exchange program Horizon, I mean, that, you know, that includes Israel, includes Armenia. If Britain stays part of that, of course we'd pay our share of the bill. So that's the second bit of money. If we have an ongoing relationship with the EU that is a close and, you know, engaged one that retains some institutional links, plainly that we wouldn't expect to get that as a gift. Then, and this is the contentious one, would we pay beyond what is legally required for the sake of an amicable overall settlement? Now, the EFTA countries do this broadly. The three EEA countries do it through one mechanism. Switzerland does it through another one. They make a voluntary contribution to upgrade infrastructure in former communist EU members and bring them up to single market standards. In exchange, although the linkage is never made official or explicit, in exchange for preferential deals in other areas. Now, you know, the Swiss do this in a very hard-headed way. They run the numbers, and if it makes sense, they pay. And I don't see any problem with Britain taking a similar hard-headed approach. We run the numbers, and if it makes sense, you know, if we decide that preferential passporting is worth a certain amount, fine. Run the numbers and pay. But obviously what we can't do is pony up without knowing what we're getting in exchange. That's where the current impasse is. And I think that the way around that, to be honest, is for us to be, if you like, a little bit more engaged with some of the other non-EU members. If we could position ourselves a little bit more as the leader of the sort of free market only countries, and then present that to the EU as, here's something we're bringing to the table, we're rationalizing all these deals, we're creating a larger market, a sort of nimbus of friends within which you can pursue your political union, doesn't that make everyone better off?
Well, finally, I think, and I hope I know the answer to this question, from a free market perspective, you're still convinced that Brexit has been the right choice?
Brexit opens the door. How we go through that door is up to us. But historically, we have always been the country that led the way in freedom, personal autonomy, the rule of law, and above all, unhindered commerce. And if we can recapture that spirit and raise our eyes to those global horizons that our forefathers took for granted, then I think we have an extremely prosperous future in front of us.
Well, that's great. Thanks. I think a perfect note to end on. Thank you, Dan.
Thank you.
Check out more podcasts, videos, blogs and research at our website, iea.org.uk, and subscribe to our YouTube channel, IEA London.